I would say, let me use an expression this morning, and you tell me what comes to mind right away. Never a dull day. My life, that pretty well sums it up, right? It's not Wall Street. Probably, my answer is probably a fairly familiar cry from a mother of little people at home. Curtain climbers or whatever you want to call them, but they are always going and always busy, and a mom doesn't, she doesn't have a chance to experience dull. Imagine that, right? Moms, I'm thinking of you, maybe dads too, but it's likely also a description of what disciples frequently thought, rarely spoke, who traveled with Jesus in the day. Put yourself in their place. There were 12 of them, and they traveled around with Jesus, and he would say things and he would do things that I'm sure more than a few occasions left them whispering to one another, never a dull day. Here he goes again. Consider what Peter must have felt in this moment, and you'll remember it. You don't need to turn there. It's when Peter asked Jesus, and he raised his voice so that everybody nearby could make sure they heard. And he asked a question of the ages. How many times shall I forgive my brother if he sins against me? Was Peter's question. And before he waited for an answer, he said, shall I forgive him 7 times? Wanting to go on record as someone who is generous, to say the least, in exceeding the prescribed 3 times of the day. And then Jesus answered him, no, Peter, you haven't gone far enough. I tell you 70 times 7, revealing the stingy nature of Peter's willingness to forgive. In one flash, he went from, let me talk about forgiveness, shall I go 7 times? And Jesus said, you know, bro, I know among your peers, that's impressive. But before me, are you kidding? I tell you 70 times 7. Jesus, in that little interaction, was presenting a picture of something that I want to talk about this morning. The something that the Bible talks a lot about. The inexhaustible grace of God. So let's establish 2 facts to help us appreciate why, when I say inexhaustible grace, or when you and I sang that song that we just sang, that God would suffer so in giving his son for people like me, it'll come real if we let it happen. 2 facts that will establish why inexhaustible grace is like, why? God, why would you do that for the likes of me? Will you write this first fact down? Jesus was sinless. Jesus was sinless. Now, when on trial, when he was pressed to the extreme, when he had been scourged and beaten, when terrible mistreatment had been suffered by Jesus, when, for the average person, brown starts to come out, you know what I'm talking about? Put a tea bag in hot water and what comes out? Okay? Put a person in a time of great crisis where they're pushed and pressed hard and brown tends to come out. So in that particular moment when he was on trial before Pilate, who was in fact an impartial Roman ruler, he was the governor of the time, upon hearing of these charges against Jesus, Pilate had this to say. We're looking for a slide, Kevin. There we go. I find no fault in him whatsoever. According to the standard of law, Pilate spoke in John 18, verse 38, I got nothing against him. You guys are making a big fuss, but none of it's sticking to him. Contrary to public opinion, according to Pilate, Jesus was innocent. He was, in fact, sinless. The Apostle Paul would later canonize that fact as he summarized in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, Jesus knew no sin. God the Father made Jesus his Son, who knew no sin, to become sin on our behalf that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And lest you and I draw a false conclusion that only Paul said such radical things, Peter chimed in when he observed, and he had a front row seat, I might add, to the sufferings of Jesus on a cross. Peter observed, in that terrible, horrible moment, Jesus committed no sin. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22. If you were to reach into the thinking of the writer of Hebrews, one last stop in making this point that Jesus was sinless. The writer of Hebrews takes time to look back at the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness. If you want a reference point, it's easy to remember. Matthew 4 and Luke 4 are where the two accounts, they completely match, describe Jesus being led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted. And Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews says, though Jesus was in fact tempted in all ways as we are, to do what? To sin. Yet he never sinned. Hebrews 4:15. So the first fact I want to just quickly frame for us, because the second fact will become a shocking contrast. The first fact, Jesus was sinless. Second fact, people are sinful. We write that down. The Old and New Testament are in complete harmony on this point. Let me be bold enough to say all people that have ever called this planet home are sinful. Present company included, and if you and I took a journey back in time, all the way back to the very first two people that lived on this planet and called a garden their home, Adam and Eve, we're not told how long they were sinless, but it wasn't very long, was it? If you know the narrative, you know it. Genesis is the beginning of that story. They actually show up late in chapter 1. They are joined in marriage in chapter 2. And in 6 verses, they went from sinless people to sinful. Did that happen in a day or two or hours? I don't know. Probably a few days would be my guess. Don't hold me to that. And don't call me wrong when you get to heaven someday. Okay, so. But the Old and New Testament agree that all humanity for all time has been sinless. In fact, let me reach into Isaiah's words. He probably has the largest arc of all in this statement in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 6. He says, all we like sheep have gone astray. Then if you fast forward and join those words from Isaiah to Paul's words in both Romans 3:23 and 6:23, you see Paul saying the same thing. All have sinned, and then he adds, and all sinners are deserving of death for their sins. So when you hear stuff like that, it hits especially we enlightened 21st century humans strange. I could take you back, and I was tempted to show a chart where we were exposed in lots of my undergraduate work and even into my graduate work to various philosophical systems and psychological systems where psychologists, this may surprise you, it may just confirm what you sort of have a hunch about, psychologists believe on the question, what is the basic nature of humans? Men and women. Show me your hand. How many think they would say the basic nature is man is pretty good? Okay, I probably set up the question so you don't dare raise your hand too high at this point. How many would say they agree that man is pretty bad? Okay, you would be wrong. Almost universally, secular psychologists say humans are good. They are good. And when asked, when pressed, then, well, explain the news. If they're so good, what's happening in my neighborhood? What's happening at the schools? I could go on and on. What? Somebody, and you know their answer? Well, that's environmental. And they don't mean environmental like it's global, whatever we're calling it now. It used to be warming, now it's climate change. Who knows? It's not environmental like, there's too much pollen, right? Or pollution. You know what they're saying? It's society. Which raises the duh question. How did society go bad? Because society is just a collection of what? Hello. You would have got an A in my class, okay? It doesn't hold. The logic falls apart. So many, like us today, we love the song, but we don't necessarily like the story, Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. And most of us go, yeah, I love that. I love it. You're gonna sing it, Pastor? This is a great song. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Whoa. Me? Remember? I'm good. That hurt. I'm not going to kid you. That's a little ouch. I mean, really? I mean, that's not very friendly. Immediately, some bristle, believing, I'm not bad. I'm not. I know bad. And when I say something like that, what am I typically doing? I'm pointing to somebody that stand out bad. I have no idea what the next person's heart's like. And they don't know what my heart's like. But we say, no, I know bad, but I'm not that bad. I had my a deep and extensive experience with this. Years ago, I was on a coast-to-coast flight from Maryland. I had visited Debbie. We were single at the time, and she lived in Maryland Beltway area. And I lived in Los Angeles, and I boarded a jet that was about a 5.5-hour flight heading west. And sat down, got kind of situated, and there was a recent development in the news. I don't even remember what it was, but it was of an epic evil, like 9/11. It was way years before that. We were seated on a DC-10. That gives you a little hint how long ago it was. No, it didn't have props, okay? So relax. But it's this big jet. We all sit down, buckle our seatbelts, and we began to talk like most of America was talking about at the time of this big evil going on. Wasn't long into our conversation, the man seated next to me discovered that I was a pastor. And so he asked a kind of an obvious question. So how would you define evil? I mean, for example, how many evil people are on this flight? And I decided to answer with a question. How many people do you think there are on this flight? And he goes, well, I don't know, maybe like 300. And I said, well, that would be my answer. Right answer, but really bad timing. Because we had 5 hours seated next to each other. And he began from that moment to try to find ways to persuade me that there are bad people out there. But his number was something like 5 on this flight. And by about the 4th hour of our flight, still withering in his cross-examination, I'm starting to think thoughts like, you know what, bro? I am going to find a way to push you out of this aircraft and show you that even a pastor has a bad, dark heart, okay? So stop it. If you haven't heard these words recently, I suggest that at the very least you read them right now. You write down the reference, and you digest this deeply, like I've been doing. The Apostle Paul uses the most sweeping language in Greek that he could reach for. when he said in Romans 3, 10 through 12, there is no one righteous. Not even one. There is, repeats himself, no one who gets it, we would say today, who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. Another sweeping judgment on humanity since Adam and Eve. They've together become worthless. There is no one who does good. He repeats himself. Not even a single one. Now, these facts that I've taken time to develop here on the front end. Jesus was sinless. All humans have always been sinful. Sets us up for a shock when we consider the way that a sinless God relates to and treats sinful people. I want to have you consider an unforgettable presentation of this God in this series, Grace, more than we deserve, better than we can imagine. We built this series on this premise from Exodus 34, when God in a self-description says, I am gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness. In his treatment of sinful people this morning, you will see just how astounding that truth is. My Bible's open to Judges in the Old Testament. Would you turn there at this time? It's the seventh book of the Bible. They start, give you a hint, at Genesis. If you're new in the Bible, that's where the book, the story of God begins, Genesis 1:1. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and you find your way to the seventh book, and just stop off in chapter 1 or so of Judges, the book of Judges, so that we can together grasp God's inexhaustible, my message title today, God's inexhaustible grace. While you're turning there, let me tell you where we're at. Israel, now led by Joshua, Moses was gone. He's Moses' successor. He and Caleb were the only two of the original refugees from Egypt who are permitted by God to lead God's people into this land flowing with milk and honey. And they make their way into the land, and now in this new land, there for less than 30 years, they jump the track spiritually. So picture this. They have been taught all this good stuff about God. They've wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They've got the bugs out, right? And then they make their way into this promised land. Josh is leading, and Josh is keeping the message clear. Walk with God. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. He goes on and on and on like that. And then less than 30 years, on the heels of Joshua's death, the people lose their way spiritually. They go crazy. They jump the tracks when it comes to spiritual things. We're told repeatedly why, but two verses worth writing down in Judges. Judges 17, verse 6. And if you forget everything else, go to the very last verse in Judges, chapter 21, verse 25, and you read words that say, you know what? These people, they had no king, and they liked it that way. My paraphrase. They had no king, and everyone did weird. You think Portland invented that? No. They've done weird. They have done as they saw fit all the way back to this time in Israel's history. Huge. So Joshua has died. Verse 1, chapter 1 says so, and then jump the page to chapter 2, verse 8. It repeats the same. And the people quickly fall into this pattern of partial obedience. What I want to set you up to appreciate is in one generation, the entire nation went crazy. Now you're ready to turn to verse 10 of chapter 2. I'll read it slowly so we really get it, everybody together. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors. That's a very soft way of saying they've all died. Okay, they're gone. We would say today, passed away. After that whole generation had passed away, another generation grew up, I'll slow down, who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Oh. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals, a false god. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed instead and worshiped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal, to name two of them, and Ashtoreth. In his anger, God's anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of raiders. No comment about the NFL team that I've been accused of liking. In his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord, watch this now, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. And what a summary statement at the end of verse 15. They were in great distress. This is very instructive for us. Let me emphasize a first feature of this that you might find surprising. It didn't take long for these people to lose their way. You'd have to admit, 30 years, that's three decades. It's not that long. It took less than that amount of time for them to lose their way. To the generation today, and this is the immediate takeaway for me, to the generation today who says to the next generation, you figure it out. You make your own decision about God. I don't want to prejudice or in any way bias you about God. So I'm going to leave it up to you. And I've actually, those are actual quotes from some parents in our enlightened new world. I say, how come you're somewhat neutral about Jesus? Well, you know, I don't want to push my religion. This passage here is rebuking such an approach. It's not even subtle. Somehow, in verse 10, all four wheels came off the bus. Christian education, listen to me now, of the next generation begins with parents, not pastors. Say, well, what's your job, pastor? Listen to me. Follow this logic. If you parents who have the best position of all, the most influential touch in the lives of your people, children or grandchildren, if you leave that to wishful thinking, hoping they catch it along the way, hoping that a teacher steps up, who's going to do that? Now, some of the parents that I rub shoulders with say, well, that's what Sunday school's about. Sunday school teachers, that's their job, that's their role. Really? Think about this. You bring your child to Sunday school. An hour a week, 2.3 Sundays a month, which is the average in churches across this country, including this church. If you add all of that up, I think I did my math right, that comes to a Sunday school teacher having an influence for less than 30 hours a year. Our stated approach as a church for the instruction of the next generation is that Sunday school plays a role to supplement but never substitute for Deuteronomy 6, which says, hey, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, train up your child. When they get up, talk about God. When they go about the way, talk about God. When they come home from school with dumb ideas, tell them about the truth. It's yours to do. Sunday school comes alongside then and says, here. And kids go, wow, they're talking the same language. That's cool. That's how it's supposed to work. That's a biblical model of how it's supposed to work. If you've drifted from that, come back to that, please. You say, I don't know how to even begin talking about God. That's why we have children's ministry directors. Any of our staff would be happy to help you find techniques and methods for living out Deuteronomy 6, for being the main voice of Christian education. Because look back now at verse 10. Verse 10 didn't just happen to those people. Verse 10 is a dynamic that can continue to happen today. And in fact, I want to suggest about halfway through verse 10, a catastrophic fail occurs. A generation of parents exit the scene, leaving children with little to no knowledge, that's what it's saying, about God and what he has done. Costly? I'll say, do you realize that this era, this age that Judges covers is 350 years, which says after this first generation of parents left, generation after generation after generation, and it keeps going for 350 years, the people went wild without restraint. If God, in my judgment, ever had a legit reason to wash his hands of sinful people, here it was. Do you remember the story that Jesus told? It was a short story, and it's really impactful, but it raises some questions. I have it on the screen for you to look at. In Luke 19, verses 12 to 14, a nobleman was called away to a distant empire to be crowned king, and then he returned. Then he was to return. Before he left, he called together 10 of his servants and divided among them 10 pounds of silver. I think I did the math. That's a pound each, roughly. Saying, invest this for me while I'm gone. But his people hated him and sent a delegation after him and said instead, we don't want you anymore. We have no interest in you being the king. So wherever you went, stay there. Basically, bug out. Thanks for the dough. In this case, silver. Appreciate it, but don't come back. Max Licato, in the book we've been telling you about, Grace, there's some copies, we'll be getting more, in that book, offers some understanding of this parable by Jesus. He says this, to sin is to state, God, I do not want you to be my king. I prefer a kingless kingdom. Or, better still, a kingdom in which I am king. Imagine if someone did the same to you. Suppose you go on a long trip and you leave your residence under the supervision of a caretaker. We call it a house sitting, okay? And you trust them with all of your possessions. But while you're away, they move into your house and they claim it for their own. They engrave their name on the mailbox, place their name on your accounts, and they plop their dirty feet up on your coffee table and invite their buddies to come move in with them and sleep in your beds. He claims your authority and sends you this message. Hey, don't come back. I'm running things now. End quote. Talk about cause for canceling someone's subscription to life. Right? If there ever was an occasion for God to press delete, there you have it. To say, y'all kidding me? Serious? No. I'm going to instantly remove you from my residence. But rather than pressing delete, and starting over. Judges is a story of, well, judges. That doesn't sound real cozy, does it? Think of Judges as a book of stories about deliverers or rescuers. In fact, he sent 7 different times using 12 different rescuers to his people who had lost their way again and again and again. So in the brief moments, I want you to see the first of this pattern that continues clear through 21 chapters of Judges. And it picks up where we left off, where the people were in great distress. Verse 15, look at what comes next. Then the Lord, instead of pressing delete, you're finished. The Lord raised up a deliverer or a rescuer, a judge, who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. They quickly turned from the ways of their ancestors who had been obedient to the Lord's commands. We learned that already. That's been established. Whenever the Lord raised up a deliverer, a judge, or a rescuer for them, he was with that judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. That's what verse 15 was getting at. They were in great distress. Look at verse 19. But when the judge died, the people returned to the ways that they were living, but now even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Why did God do this? What drove God to restrain a deserved judgment and instead to deliver his people? Not once or twice, but again and again and again, repeatedly. Will you write this down? Grace is what led to this outcome. God's inexhaustible grace. The people would live in peace and calm, and in that place, they were blessed by God. And then slowly they would turn from God until a full-blown crisis came into their lives. At which time they would cry out in confession of their sin. And God would come through. That's about the place where I'm inclined to say, you know something? You made your bed. How does it go? Go ahead and sleep in it. But not God. Not God. Not just this one occasion that I took time to read for you this morning, but the rest of the book. Every single time his people, as a result of their own sin, cried out for help in great distress, and he sent help. There's never a speech in Judges that says, I'm done, you're through. You made that bed, cozy up. A rescuer was sent. And peace and calm and blessing was restored. Y'all, this is the Christian message. Some of you this morning hearing this are actually already making the application. You're seeing this pattern in your own life. You're living, maybe right now, in this cycle. You're living the dream. You're living in peace and plenty. You could probably describe your days right now as prosperous. This is a good time. But somewhere, and for reasons you still scratch your head, you became spiritually complacent. You treated really important things like coming together. Hebrews 3 and Hebrews 10 says, don't forsake it. It's not good for you to periodically gather with other Christians and worship and hear the word. And you don't know exactly how this happened, but you know, you on Saturday you're like, well, let's see, we could go to the Sunday tomorrow, we get the day off, we could go to the beach. Ah, it's a little rainy over there. Go to the mountain, no, it's a little cold. We could do yard work. Yuck, who wants to do that? Okay, we'll go to church. I'm not describing everybody I know. How else do you explain 2.3 times a month? And I'm not, please don't make my statement superficial like the true test of spirituality if you show up on Sunday morning. That's not it. Not even close. But it's this question that raises thoughts of spiritual apathy. Who's got the yawns spiritually? You're indifferent. You're not sure how it happened, but you actually, it would be correct to say you're lost today. And then somehow, also unexpectedly, pain, like a set of waves starts to crash into your life. And they get bigger. And they eventually start to knock you down. And you get to a place where you too cry out. And you even make statements to God like, I promise to change it up, God. I don't want to go there anymore. I'm going to take a different path. And then wonderfully, God comes through. And God provides. And God forgives. And he heals. And he restores. And you say to yourself, I'm back. Back to living the dream. And then you repeat. What keeps God from folding his arms, wagging his head and turning his back? And say, you know what? Hope you like that bed. I'll tell you what. His inexhaustible grace. I want to close with a shocking picture of God's grace. It's truly more than we deserve and better than we can imagine. As I read this, and it's difficult to read, I would urge you to stay with me in it. Don't turn it off because it's too tough to hear. Let's imagine that you have a 6-year-old son whom you love dearly. Tragically, one day you discover that your son was horribly murdered. After a lengthy search, the investigators of the crime find the killer. And they arrest him. And you're now faced with a choice. If you used every means in your power to kill the murderer for his crime, that would be vengeance. If, however, you're content to let the legal authorities take over and execute on him what is proper, a fair trial, a plea of guilty, capital punishment, that is justice. But if you should plead for the pardon of the murderer, forgive him completely. Invite him into your home and adopt him as your own son. That is grace. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. It is, for any honest person, it's more than amazing. It's absolutely out of reach. For us to even conceive of such a thing. I'll say what I think many would say. I get stuck at vengeance. If something like that were to happen to my wife or children. And then I realized that that very scene took place on a cross. Where God could have ended everything right there, removed his son safely from that situation and caused us all to pay the price. But he didn't. And he forgave us, found a way to give us a future, and did something none of us could see coming. He offered us a place in his own family at the cost of his son. A story like that's not meant to just be an impressive moment to any of us. It's meant to be a presentation of the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you've been going to church a long time, but you've never got it until this moment, and you're saying, you know, Pastor, I've had a more basic and honestly a distorted view of grace, of the gospel. Today I want to make it all different. I want to start out fresh. I want to invite you. I want to plead with you to come into my life and to make me your son or daughter. I want to pray for you this morning. If I've just described you for whatever reason, doesn't matter if you've been here for years, I want you to look up at me right now because I want to pray for you. Thank you. It doesn't surprise me. There are a lot of people. It doesn't surprise you either, Lord. This is truth. And I pray that those that looked up and are saying, God, I want that. I want you. I want, because you didn't run from me. You didn't tell me you're on your own, dude. You blew it once too many times. You've extended your grace, which I don't even have a good explanation for. I would have given up on me a long time ago. But for you to want me to be your son, to invite me into your home, to actually promise me a forever with you, it changes everything. It changes how I worship you, how I serve you, how I engage in what you left us to do, to worship you, fellowship, and grow, and serve, sacrifice. I want to do all of that, not because I got to, because it's just little ways I can say thank you, Jesus, for not giving up on me. Beginning now with our worship, Lord, help us to sing with heart and soul, full of gratitude for your inexhaustible grace.